It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. We've got a great panel for you. Father Robert Ballester, Harry McCracken, the Technologizer, and from theinformation.com, Jessica Lesson. We'll talk about the latest news from Apple, Google, Microsoft, and more. Stay tuned. This Week in Tech is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 435, recorded December 8th, 2013, 2.6% Neanderthal. This Week in Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces from Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients anywhere. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. Even present from an iPad. Try it free for 30 days. No credit card required to get started. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter TWIT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT12. And by SumAll. Easily connect your data from Google, Twitter, YouTube, PayPal, Amazon, Facebook, and more to gain important insights instantly. All in one beautiful interface. Start using it for free today at SumAll.com. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show that covers your week's tech news. And we have a fun panel today. I'm really pleased to welcome back Harry McCracken, the Technologizer from Time.com. Good to see you, Harry.
Great to be here.
Also here, Father Robert Ballester, host of This Week in Enterprise Tech, our enterprise show. Know-how, our How to Do It show, and soon, Coding 101. I know you did your beta.
Yep.
People were already emailing me, where can I get that show?
We've decided that we're going to back it off a little bit. I believe our beta was probably a little bit too advanced, and thankfully we have Snubs, right? She said, You know what?
I didn't get that.
Let's break it down.
Yeah. Shannon says break it down a lot. I don't know if that's what she means, so Coding 101, that'll be, we're in beta for a little while, and then we'll have a final version.
On Thursdays.
And it's appropriate because, you know, this is the Computer Science Education Week. Starting on Monday. Did you know that?
Yeah.
And the Hour of Code.
I love that idea.
Look, this cracks me up, though, on the video for this. They've got Will I Am,
who is known as a prolific coder.
He writes a lot of code, doesn't he? Yeah, I think in between writing hit songs for the Black Eyed Peas.
And none of us know how to read and write code.
The first program I wrote asked things like, what's your favorite color?
Drew from Dropbox.
Or, how old are you?
I wrote a...
Bill from Microsoft.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
I first learned how to...
Elena from Clothia.com.
Red square appear on the screen.
You're just trying to make something.
Chris from the Miami Heat. He's a coder. I love it.
To the computer or to a tablet.
And then this guy, Mark... Works at
the whole someplace. Limit of the system is just that they're just aren't
looks so familiar.
I, know.
I think I went to school with them.
The programmers of tomorrow,
Gabe Newell,
the future. You know, you're going to look like you have magic powers compared to everybody else.
Great coders are today's rock stars.
I do have magic powers.
That's it.
I love it. So they're encouraging students all over the country to at least just spend an hour learning how to write code. I think it's a great idea. So good for you, Coding 101.
Coding 101.
Perfect way to do that. Also here, I'm really thrilled. We've been trying to get her on the show for a while, but she's been a little busy. Jessica Lesson, formerly of The Wall Street Journal, now of The Information. Hi, Jessica.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So great to have you. Congratulations. The Information launched this week.
It did. We're off to a strong start, and it's excited to be out there and able to get feedback on what we're doing.
Yeah. Do you call it The Information or TheInformation.com? Am I saying it wrong?
We call it The Information, but TheInformation.com is the website,
right.
So either works.
And the idea is, and Jessica, by the way, wrote many really good byline pieces for The Wall Street Journal. That's where I first became aware of you. We've been trying to get you on TWiT since then, breaking a lot of news there. And then, like a lot of people, I think, people have left The Times, left The Journal, Walt Mossberg, Kara Swisher, people like that. You decided to do it yourself.
Yeah, I suppose that some of the entrepreneurial spirit in the Valley runs off on you, but it really boiled down to thinking about sort of our audiences. And so at the Journal, and I loved working there, I felt that the audience was becoming a more general audience, and tech and the importance of technology to business was exploding, and that there was a demand for a publication that focused more on professionals and was at a little more sophisticated level that you could be at if you were writing for a more general audience. So this was something that was sort of in my back of my head for a while. And earlier this year, I decided that we wanted to go try and build it.
You know, we've been quoting stories from JessicaLessen.com all year. You got Amira Frati, who's another great byline. You've really been doing a good job. How big is your team? How many people are you going to have working for you?
We're 5 full-time and 8 in total and hiring. So shoot me an email if anyone's interested.
8 journalists?
Not 8 journalists. 8 is our full team, which will include engineers, right. An artist. Right. So we're basically 5 journalists.
5 journalists. And I gather the idea is, and this makes sense to me. I always said, you know, we don't do a paywall. We're advertising supported. And I always said that if you're going to have a paywall, you got to make money for people. That the only reason people are going to pay for content is if they could see a direct benefit to them.
Absolutely. That's actually the main thing we think about. I mean, I think that you can't think about a paywall and is it a good thing or a bad thing or what kind of paywall to use without thinking about the content behind it and what that's going to be worth to people. And so we're out there at $39 a month or $399 a year at a price point that's really geared towards people who are going to expect to learn a lot and get a business advantage from our content. And I think that's the only way that we can justify that. And that's what we spend 100% of our time thinking about, is how to deliver that kind of content. But there's a lot of interest in paywalls and business models in the media business, but I don't think there's enough recognition that it really matters what's behind that paywall and who that's targeted at in terms of whether or not it will work. So this is our bet that there's a nice audience fit at that price point with our content.
Yeah, Rupert Murdoch has famously tried paywalls, but there's a big difference between the Wall Street Journal, which clearly makes money for its readers and for which I pay, and something like the Daily Mail, which is no reason to pay for. And so where he's done paywalls on just kind of general content, it doesn't seem to have worked, I think. Did you ever consider a paywall for the Technologizer, Harry?
No, really. We did not. I mean, partially because we were not aiming at business people. We were writing for consumers.
You recognized also that's you got to have some.
So our business model was a little bit of advertising, although not exclusively advertising, because if you depend entirely on ad impressions, you'll either kill yourself or you'll hate yourself.
We haven't done yet either, I promise.
So we did that. So okay. we did we had some sponsorships. We created some content for other folks. We did some events.
Yeah.
And we also stayed intentionally small.
Yeah. Yeah. I watch with interest because, you know, we always have to think about how we monetize. We're pretty happy with our monetization strategy, but I think there's plenty of room for, and it's great to see a bunch of experimentation, a bunch of different ways of doing this. Good luck, Jessica. I think it's great.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Let's get to some of the top stories of the week. Usually it's a little slow this time of year. Thank God for Jeff Bezos, who keeps things interesting. Right after the show last week, I went home. I ran home because 60 Minutes, Jeff Bezos is on, Charlie Rose. And this is where I think there is a difference between mainstream media and tech media. Charlie Rose says, Jeff is going to show us something no one else has seen. And Jeff opens the door and Charlie goes, I mean, really? And what it was, of course, and we've all talked about it for the past week, is delivery drones. This is a very, even Bezos said, a very beta idea. And of course, the first thing everybody said is, oh, come on. The first thing that's going to happen, somebody's dog get chewed up by a drone dropping off a package, is going to be the end of that. FAA approval, of course, the limitations. But I was interested to see it is not brand new. There is a company, for instance, that's been using drones or trying drones in Haiti for earthquake relief in Haiti, that there are places without roads that a drone makes a lot of sense. But how much of this was a media play and how much of this is serious?
I actually think he's really serious. Amazon's warehouses are a thing of technological beauty. They are completely automated. The picking process, which normally takes an army of workers where they would go to different shelves and put together an order, that's all done by robotics. So in his mind, I could see him saying, well, why don't we just extend that automatic process one step further? Rather than dropping it into the assembly area where it gets put into boxes, why not put it into a crate that gets automatically delivered to the customer?
Yeah. And it has to be a certain object, and it has to
under
be...
Under 5 pounds.
And it has to be a nearby delivery. Obviously, these drones can't go miles. I think if that guy had come out the door or the kid had come out the door 30 seconds earlier, he would have been chopped into pieces. So that's a problem.
And actually, I mean, it ties into the other Amazon news, which is that the Supreme Court says that they won't hear Amazon make the case they don't need to charge sales taxes for other states.
How does that try to the drone?
Because once that's over, essentially, Amazon doesn't have a reason to avoid being in a lot of states. Up until now, it's tried to be in as few states as possible. Right. So when I order stuff in California,
it comes from
Nevada.
Yeah.
If you have to charge sales tax, you might as well have more facilities.
Right.
You're not going to be able to do drones if you only have a few large warehouses far away from metropolitan areas.
They have 91 fulfillment centers. I mean, Amazon is huge. In fact, one of the reasons Amazon has historically not turned profits is they decided since the dot-com bust to invest in fulfillment centers and infrastructure. Bezos is a master. I think it's really interesting to watch somebody build a business designed not to make any money for a long time. I mean, he's really thinking long term. So drones, if you think that long term, drones doesn't seem that crazy.
Well, I mean, everyone's making fun of it because, of course, you could poke fun at the individual scenario. Well, if you're further than 10 miles away, it won't work. Right, well, if it's heavier than 5 pounds, it won't work. Right. Well, if the drone malfunctions, it's going to fall on your car, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
That's a good problem.
But, I mean, look back through the history of innovation. There were so many things that people thought, well, that's stupid. Right. That's crazy. That's ridiculous. Right. The technological hurdles are just amazing. And they've become backbones. I mean, the internet itself is one of those things. So, yes. Does it sound crazy? Yes. Is it technologically impossible? No.
Right.
So I'd say if it's not technologically impossible, something like this is eventually going to take hold. Now, whether or not it's Amazon or someone else who takes this idea and runs with it, that remains to be seen.
And presumably, delivery trucks hit people every day. And,
right.
You know,
That's a good point.
We don't pay attention to it because we've been used to that for decades and decades. We're willing to put up with danger and problems once we understand that stuff is valuable.
Jessica, you think Jeff Bezos is serious?
Oh, I think he's very serious. I do think he's underestimating the regulatory. He's probably not underestimating it, but he is a little nonchalant about the regulatory issues that still remain. I think he, in that 60 Minutes segment, had some forecast for when the FAA is licensed or expected to approve some of the usage for commercial usage for drones. And I think what I've read is less ambitious. So I think they're dead serious. I think it's certainly coming. But like any other new category, Google Glass, et cetera, I think we're going to have some battles play out in Washington. And maybe Amazon will go ahead. And you know, my big takeaway from this announcement was that they wanted to put some pressure on folks, you know, get a little bit of a buzz and pop before the holiday for Amazon, but put some pressure on Washington and the industry. Because there are going to be a lot of battles in the coming years over this.
It's interesting because the consensus seems to be, and you guys all pretty sharp on this, that this wasn't a publicity stunt so much as really something he's serious about.
I think it's both a stunt and serious. I mean, the fact they're talking about it now, long, long, long before they can actually do it, is a stunt. But that doesn't mean they don't really want to do it.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that it won't happen in some form from somebody within our lifetime.
This is a hacker's paradise, though. I mean, just the geek side of me is hoping.
Take over the drone.
Please do this, because I'm going to order something, have it come to my house, shoot it down or capture it, and figure out how it works, and then reverse engineer it.
There is nothing really to get you keep you from catching the leg
really
of that drone
right.
before
it
leaves.
It's going to land in your house.
We've played with the quadcopters. They're really cool. I mean, I really like it. And there's all sorts of uses for drones beyond delivery. I mean, I think there's no question we're going to see not just in law enforcement and military, but drones for all sorts of purposes. The idea of autonomous vehicles are fascinating, frankly.
I mean, this is as much of a PR stunt as the Hyperloop was for Elon Musk. I mean,
yeah, but Elon didn't put a penny into the Hyperloop.
He just said it. Yeah, he just said it, and people are running with it. Maybe Bezos is hoping that people will do that with this technology.
It looked like
I actually think Robert. I mean, I think it's much less of a stunt, to be honest. I mean, I think that the Hyperloop is an idea in Elon's notebook, but I think these I mean, I think these drones are coming, and Amazon is very, very serious about them. So I like the sentiment, but I think that, you know, there's a lot of discussion. Google is working on a lot of technology in this area as well. I would be shocked if there wasn't a major tech company that wasn't thinking about this as a platform. So it's in my two cents, but I think that this is going to be very serious technology.
Well, Jessica, you would know this. You've got your pulse on the inside of business. Is there visionary envy among some of these big names?
Yes.
That, you know, they hate it when someone else comes up with that idea that inspires people. They want to be the person that says, here's a crazy thing, now make it work.
Absolutely. And I also think it's visionary envy among the egos, but also among the companies, largely for recruiting purposes as well. I mean, I think that if you're an engineer and you see those videos from Jeff Bezos and Amazon and drones, Amazon is a place you want to work. It's a place where cool stuff is going to happen. So there's a lot of brinkmanship in the look how cool I am these days. I think Google's sort of playing that card as well. They've got Google X, you know, their place for experimental moonshots. I think we'll talk a bit more about Andy and his robots later. So I feel that for sure in the industry right now.
I love it. Visionary envy.
I like it.
That's the woofies these days is I got the most visionary plan. Yeah, let's talk about Andy Rubin. Andy Rubin, the head of the Android division until he left a few months ago. At the time, I speculated I knew Rubin was really into robots. That's why Android is named Android. And I think Larry, maybe it was Sergey, said he's going to be doing a moonshot. Well, we now know what the moonshot is. We'll talk about that in just a bit. Jessica Lesson is here from theinformation.com, Father Robert Ballister of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and the technologizer, Harry McCracken from time.com. Our show today brought to you by our good friends at Citrix, the makers of GoToMeeting. This is a time of year when meetings are hard. And, you know, I bet you that Jessica's staff isn't all in the same room. I know ours isn't. People travel, people get sick, but you still have to get together. You still have to share great ideas, do a little visionary thinking with your coworkers, and that's where meetings really do make a difference. But nowadays, online meetings make it a lot easier, and there's no easier way to do an online meeting than GoToMeeting from Citrix. GoToMeeting lets you share the same screen with your coworkers and clients and colleagues online, not just from a computer, by the way, Mac or PC, but from mobile devices as well. You can even present from an iPad, which is pretty cool to be sitting out in the garden if it's a nice day. Sitting in the jacuzzi if it's a snowy day, and working on the iPad and presenting to a client. I'm in the jacuzzi. Would you? Let's talk. You also get the HD faces, and you may not want to turn that on in the hot tub, but the HD faces means you can see each other face-to-face in crystal clear HD video. Just turn on your webcam, and there you guys are. I just think it's fabulous. I know a lot of teams keep GoToMeeting running all day as a way to collaborate in remote locations. No credit card to get started. You could try it for 30 days. You'll get it started in seconds on your computer or mobile device when you visit GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button, a big red button in the middle there, and use the promo code TWIT. 30 days free. As you know, by the way, we're going to have a little contest. We do this from time to time. As you know, GoToMeeting with HD Faces lets you meet face-to-face with your team no matter where in the world everyone's located. Well, we want to know where in the world you would like to host your ideal GoToMeeting. Tweet us a picture of your answer. You can steal the picture. Doesn't have to be one you took. Using the hashtag WinTwit. That's hashtag WINTWIT. And don't forget to make it at GoToMeeting as well so that they can see it. And you'll be entering for a chance to win an Apple gift card valued at $300 toward any Apple hardware accessory purchased in Apple retail stores or the Apple online store, courtesy of our friends at Citrix. Remember, tweet us a picture this time of where in the world you'd like to host your ideal GoToMeeting using the hashtag WinTwit and at GoToMeeting. The contest ends December 12th. The winner will be announced on the December 15th episode of this show. That's 1 week from now, so don't waste any time. Contest open, I'm sorry, to only U.S. residents. Hey, that's the law, folks. For contest rules and regulations, visit inside.twit.tv/contests. Apple registered trademark of Apple, Inc. Apple is not a participant or sponsor of this promotion. Thank you, lawyers. GoToMeeting.com. Try it free today. Use the promo code TWIT. Andy Rubin, I've read stories about Andy. You go to his house, a robot answers the door. It's like the Jetsons. There's robots everywhere. So it wasn't much of a surprise when I read the article in the Times about Andy Rubin. His next job at Google is designing robots. Robots for, it sounds like for business more than for consumer. Not like a Android in your house butler.
Supply chain stuff, apparently.
Supply chain, for instance, it writes John Markoff in the Times, if Amazon can imagine delivering books by drone, is it too much to think Google might be planning to one day have one of its robots hop off an automated Google car and race to your doorstep delivering a package? It might be a little anthropomorphic, but I guess it's possible. Ruben's a smart guy. Is this, I wonder, though, is this, you know, Andy, I think, had done everything he could do at Android, and it really was probably time for him to move on. Is this a case of, well, we just want to keep this guy inside the company, so give him something fun to do until we think of something better? Or is this really serious?
Well, Google is extremely serious about its moonshots, including ones that are far off.
Ruben says it's a 10-year plan.
And self-driving cars is more than 10 years, but they're several years into that and have made a lot of progress. So the fact it sounds pie in the sky and unlikely to matter immediately doesn't mean that Google is not dead serious about it.
Go ahead, Jessica. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So at the information we reported the same day as the Times story, a very similar story that talked about Andy and working on robots. And we also hear that it's not just manufacturing. So I think in the short term, yes, that's what they're focused on. But Andy has a lot of ambitious ideas and has been thinking, you know, about what would it be like for humans to get used to having assistants and people, essentially robots, with them in their lives. So I think that's the scale he's thinking on. We know a little bit more about the project, but we know that it's being called Replicant, which of course refers to the robots in Blade Runner. So keeping with his naming convention of sticking to robots. And he has a massive office complex in California Avenue in Palo Alto that has a ton of manufacturing equipment that he may open up to startups as well, or to companies he's close to. So there's a lot to watch in the project, but you know, I think both we and the Times had reported Google's acquired a number of companies in this effort. You know, it is part of Google, so this isn't just Andy, although it often is just Andy when he has his projects going. But it's exciting, and we, you know, he's pulled people from Android to work on it. It's pretty hush hush, but it sounds there's some real momentum building now, and I think he's going to really try to get robots into the mainstream in a way that, you know, they haven't been, and we're probably many, many years away from, but he has a vision around that, and it's going to be fun to watch.
I think Amir, it was Amir who said he was walking down California Avenue and looked up the stairs at the office, and there's some sort of robot at the top of the stairs. Did he say that?
I think it was. He may have. I know there are robots outside the Android building, or some just sort of replicas of them. But Andy has a ton of robots at Google. He had one that was trained as a coffee barista to make coffee.
See, you didn't have to go to Starbucks. You need to
call up Google. Come on, let's go.
Oh. It's part of his quirkiness and passion, and I think it's. It's exciting for him to be at this phase. You know, the one thing we do hear from folks who are close to the project is that everyone continues to say how ambitious it is. And there's very much a sense of how are we going to do this? But that's often a good sign that you're onto something, I think, if you feel that way. So
I wonder if Google has to be sensitive at all to the Skynet factor. The idea that maybe it's not such a good idea to build autonomous robots, and everybody's a little afraid of Google anyway, and the last thing you want is Google to have autonomous robots that are. How sensitive when you guys talk to people like Larry and Sergey? How sensitive are they to that the common person might be a little scared by this idea?
I think it's interesting because I was thinking about that when in the follow on from Amazon. So Amazon announces it's working on drones, and I didn't read a lot of concerns about privacy and surveillance. I'm sure they were there, but that wasn't the knee-jerk reaction we had to that announcement.
Right.
If it had come from Google, I think it would have been the knee-jerk reaction.
You bet.
And
you bet.
I think that I think this gnaws at people at Google. So I think the company, Google, is very aware that they're going to have to, that this is going to be a problem for them and in getting mainstream adoption of their technologies. I'm not sure how much of a concern it is at the point of creating these projects and in terms of the engineers, how front and center it is. But clearly the company at large thinks a lot about it. But this was one of those examples where I think Google has to be, you know, they have to be thinking about these things, and everyone's right to stress test on them. But they, you know, we should be asking the same questions of Amazon, and I haven't heard a lot of that. So
you guys at theinformation.com also broke the news that Google's working on something for next year they call Nexus TV.
I can't read
the article because I haven't paid for it, but I will soon. But can you just tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Only if you promise to subscribe.
I won't tell anybody.
But, no.
Wait a minute. Let me ask you something. Because, okay, I'm going to subscribe, and then I'm going to read the article. Now, how much of that, I mean, don't you worry that people like us will just say, hey, let me just tell you what the information said?
It's a great question, and our dear friends at Business Insider have promised to put out all the news that they think is worthwhile out of our stories.
That's nice.
You know what? That's absolutely okay, because we think the value proposition to our subscribers isn't just the headlines. It isn't just the facts that people are going to talk about and share on Twitter and elsewhere. It's why they matter. It's the context. It's the rest of the story. It's getting that information first before everyone else, if that's valuable to you.
It's just an ad for the information. If I say, hey, the information had the story, that's just a pointer right back to you.
I think so. And the reason I'm confident in that is that that was sort of what happened when I was at the Journal for 8 years. We were also behind a paywall. Right. And when we had stories that warranted picking up by other outlets, they would pick it up. But it didn't cannibalize our core base. And so that's the attitude we're taking. Yeah. About the story, though, we hear that Google is getting ready to, as soon as sort of the first quarter of next year, launch another one of these cheap set-top boxes, kind of like the Apple TV, something that does not replace cable or TV, but gets you Hulu and web video. And in this case, also games. I think having a gaming console and something that in some way can stand up against the Xbox and the PlayStation is what Google has in mind here. Of course, Google, many years ago, focused primarily on Google as a beat reporter. And I was writing about Google TV and a whole slew of products that were their attempts to get into the living room. This is another one. We saw Chromecast earlier this year, which basically helps push stuff that's on your computer or tablet onto a bigger TV. This category actually boggles me a little bit, because I think we see so many, Rokus and Amazon's coming up with a box and Google. And I just kind of wonder what it is about this around $100 category that doesn't seem to be really taking off, that has all these guys pushing forward. And I think what it amounts to is that no one can afford to not get a toehold in the living room in terms of delivering advertising or delivering other kinds of content. People are going to want to get it on their bigger screens. And I think these companies feel like they have to have a presence there. And they haven't been able to do big deals with the cable companies or the satellite companies or the other providers. So they're going at it on their own. I just don't know how many $100 sort of little boxes we need to plug into our screens. So
it's not a big selling category. Apple TV, 13 million units. Roku, the next biggest, 8 million units. That's 21 million total. Add a few more for Google TV. I doubt they sold more than a dozen. Yeah. Those of us who use them love them. In fact, Harry Time Magazine named the Chromecast the product of the year.
We like the Chromecast, and in both Roku and Apple have done well, but there have been dozens of products in this category that have completely failed. So it's really hard to do well. And it's not.
Well, and maybe the consumers don't want it. Maybe people just say, look, I got it in my TV. The smart TVs do most of that.
Enough. I mean, I know lots of people in my family who have Rokus who are not gadget freaks. So it is a category, but it may be enough to have sort of two healthy competitors rather than more. And I'm not entirely sure what Google will do that will be wildly different from what's out there already.
I think that they're, it's interesting, Jessica, you said gaming, because that makes me think of the Ouya. Yeah. which is a very inexpensive Android game, or you could bring it in at under $99. In fact, you put Plex on the Ouya, which you can do, and it really is kind of everything that this would be. But it's not compelling from a, you know, it definitely does not compete against the PlayStation or the Xbox. It's not a hardcore gamer's box. In fact, on Wednesday on Triangulation, I had Adam Sessler on. We talked about gaming. And I asked him that. He said, no. From a gamer's point of view, the Ouya is a non-starter. It's not that good. And I can't imagine anything Google. I mean, sure, it'll be an Android or a Chrome OS device. Android, it's not going to compete, I don't think.
You know, there's a wisdom that we've had for a while that has said, look, when you crack it, people will come.
Apple TV, the Chromecast.
Yeah. Right. So you need to have the right price point. It has to be simple enough. It has to work with what people have. It has to have content. We've seen products that actually have those things, and we still haven't seen that boost of sales. So I got to be asking myself, was that wisdom wrong? Was it not, if you crack it, they will come? It's now people actually don't really want this. Not that they want to get rid of it, but it's never going to be popular. Those who want to watch content over the internet are going to do it on their computers or their computers connected to a screen. Those people who just want to watch cable TV probably aren't going to want a crossover device. And all those products caught in the middle will sell a few million, but they're never going to become as ubiquitous as a tablet or a PC.
It strikes me that at least for some of the market, Microsoft's got it right, which is you make a powerful gaming machine, very, very expensive, $500, but it has media content capabilities. That's actually something I welcomed into my living room because of the variety of things it did. I can play really good games on it, and I can watch Netflix on it. I can watch Amazon streaming, and I can watch a Blu-ray on it. It's a good, to me, it's overpriced. They'll have to get the price down, but it's a good media device.
The consoles are the most successful TV streaming devices. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I mean, every TV is going to have some sort of functionality built into it. And when that
happens. Well, it does. I mean, my TV's, all of the.
Yeah, I mean, every new TV
I can watch
does.
Netflix in five different ways on any given set.
Mm-hmm. When that happens, it's not entirely clear what the $100 box does what that your TV add? Doesn't do. Yeah. Having said that, we have a Roku, which we use every day. There is value there.
I guess my point is that we're a bad sample. I mean, we're geeks. And so Chromecast is great. I plug it in my HDMI and it gets it from your Wi-Fi. And I can open up my Android device and I can say YouTube. I can find it on YouTube and send it over the Chromecast. But I wonder, I mean, do you have any sales figures for the Chromecast? I mean, why did you make it the product of the year?
Because over the last few years, I've reviewed a whole bunch of products that attempted to do exactly the same thing, bridging the gap between your computer and your TV. Most of them have been like $150, $200, sometimes more. They didn't work well. They were clunky. And the Chromecast is incredibly cheap, and it does it well in a straightforward way. And yes, it's not for everybody and their grandma. Right. It is for people who have at least a tiny bit of geek in them.
$35 though, does... And they're selling it at Walmart and Kmart.
And that price range, it's kind of irresistible.
Yeah, it's an impulse purchase.
And it is essentially the opposite of Google TV. Google TV was expensive and wildly ambitious and tried to do 2,000 different things
and
did not do well. Chromecast is one thing, does it well, does it cheap.
One thing that the Xbox One does that the Google TV did that I think it's unique in this category, but I really like, is the idea of pass-through. I put my cable or satellite box into the Xbox One, and then the Xbox One into the television, so it becomes an overlay over my TV viewing. And that adds some interesting capabilities. They showed off at the announcement for the Xbox One, what is it, almost a year ago, they showed you watching a football game, but you've got your NFL.com snapped to the screen, and you can watch your fantasy football stats updated in real time while you're watching a real game. Things like that, I think, are pretty compelling. But it did, and I liked it with Google TV, but it didn't sell anybody.
But I think Microsoft is actually on the right track with that. That is one thing that none of the other boxes are doing, which is...
Isn't that interesting?
Can I have a system that's just always there? I don't have to switch inputs. Right. I don't have to worry about what's connected to what. I wave at the Kinect sensor, and suddenly it comes across the screen. That's that idea of always on other screen functionality. Maybe that's the secret sauce. Maybe that's going to get copied because, like, for example, it's my TV and my DVD player and my receiver and my game console can all play Netflix, but my parents never use those because they don't want to figure out what's on what input and they don't want to accidentally switch away from the cable box and they can't watch TV anymore. But If I tell them, look, to watch Netflix, just raise your hand and say Netflix, and the menu comes up, they will absolutely.
If that really
do that.
Worked well,
if that really worked,
it would. And you don't even have to wave your hand. When I come into the room, the Xbox One sees that Leo is here, logs me in. I could say Xbox, watch HBO, and it actually does do that. But it's still, if it's it needs yet. To be, it needs to be like 98% of accurate and reliable. Otherwise, it's too frustrating. I think for normal,
you end up yelling at the air.
Yeah, I do think there's promise in this category, and I don't know if a Google Nexus is going to be any better than the Google TV was. It's a challenge. Let's take a break. We come back with more. Jessica Lesson from TheInformation.com, Harry McCracken from Time.com, The Technologizer. I can still call you that, right?
All my content has that.
It feels like a superhero. I am The Technologizer. I'm here to polish up your Chrome. Whoa, cast. Father Robert Ballester. Do you still call yourself the Digital Jesuit?
Sometimes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just checking. From This Week in Enterprise Tech, Brian Chee from Twiat is also here.
That's right. Another one of my Twiat co-hosts is in the
wearing
house.
The wildest hat I've ever seen.
We'll have to come up afterwards.
Yeah, get him to show off the hat in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. The holidays are here. The last thing you want to do is fight off the amateurs at the post office. You know, the people who only go to the post office once a year with an arm full of packages, a Christmas card list. If you do mailing for a living, you know, you got to get the thing done. And that's why I love Stamps.com. We use it here. We actually have two accounts because we use it so much. The idea is you can do everything you do at the post office from your desk using your computer, your printer. You don't need a postage meter. You don't need expensive postage meter ink. You don't need to bring it to the weirdest thing is to buy a postage meter and then have to go to the post office to charge it up. That's nuts. Stamps.com, it's all online. When the stamp rates go up, as they always do, it's automatically handled. You get a USB scale. You could just plop a letter or a package on. You always have exactly the right postage. No more guessing. And Stamps.com kind of does all the grunt work for you. It takes your return address, puts it on the envelope or the mailing label, takes the address. If you're selling on Etsy, Amazon, eBay, PayPal, it will take the address from the website. You don't have to type it in, so there's fewer mistakes. It's more accurate. They'll even send out an email when you use Priority Mail or Priority Express Mail. They'll send out an email to the recipient with a tracking number automatically. It's like real hardcore fulfillment from your desk. They even have a button at Stamps.com that will call the mail carrier to you. So this is the one thing the post office does so well. 6 days a week, somebody comes to your door, brings you stuff, takes stuff. Take advantage of the stuff the post office does best while doing the stuff you need to do fast and easy. You want to try it right now? Visit Stamps.com. Go up to the top of the page there and click that old-fashioned radio microphone on the right and enter the offer code TWIT. We're going to take that offer and, spell it right. TWIT is spelled TWIT. And you're going to get $110 value, $55 in free postage to use over the first few months at Stamps.com. The digital scale is yours. You just pay shipping and handling. I think it's $5. And by the way, that's yours to keep. Cancel anytime. Just keep the scale. $5 supply kit and, of course, a four-week trial of Stamps.com. I love it because, I can actually get stamps from Stamps. Did you know this? Well, they come in and they print out stamps on little sticky, and I don't have to lick it or anything.
I heard that Stamps.com is actually going to be using quadcopters to pick up your mail. They're working on that
technology.
Wouldn't
that be awesome? I used to have stamps from Stamps.com that had my picture. Talk about narcissistic. They had my picture on it. I don't know. I never used them.
I would buy Leo stamps.
I was embarrassed to use them. I was like, I can't do this. This is crazy. Looks like it's a deal. It's a done deal. Microsoft and Nokia get the approval of both the U.S. and Finnish governments and the EU or the EC as well. So come early next year, Nokia, the former Finnish tire company that got into cell phones, will be part of Microsoft. And Stephen Elop, the CEO of Nokia, will be inside Microsoft once again, making him a front runner for CEO. Let's talk about the CEO because there's never been a list released from Microsoft, but it seems like we all know who the candidates are. Jessica, you might have the inside story on that. Do you know who's going to
be? I can't guess at this point, and we're not hearing anything in particular about the handicapping. I mean, there was a lot of excitement about Alan Mulally from Ford, and then I think
He's kind of denied it. He was on CNBC.
Sort of, but not really.
It was a non-denial.
He sort of denied it, and now he's sort of renewed his contract through next year. So I think, you know, it's hard to say. The only concrete thing I hear is that, and I think All Things D reported this as well, that the sort of Silicon Valley insiders are all lobbying for Tony Bates, who obviously ran Skype and came into Microsoft through that. So all I can say about the pool right now is I think that there's some attention still to sort of inside candidates, but it feels like to a lot of people that the board is going to continue to look outside. And I also don't think anything's imminent for this year. I think that while the board had maybe been hoping that was a case, I heard recently that there were some new interviews and new people going through the process that made that seem unlikely.
You know what? They're having a really hard time. John Thompson, who's leading the search, he's on the Microsoft board, former executive at IBM, and an African-American who would, I think, in many people's minds, be an excellent CEO candidate, has recused himself. He says, no, I don't want to run. Of course, Dick Cheney did the same thing. But I think that Tony Bates makes a lot of sense, except he's only recently been part of Microsoft. And you know, Mary Jo Foley pointed this out from allaboutmicrosoft.com and our Windows Weekly show. We were talking about this with Mail at Mary Jo and Paul Theroux, that Microsoft probably needs somebody who's pretty familiar with Microsoft's business. It is a hairball. There's a lot of divisions, a lot of different businesses. It's devices, it's services, it's operating systems, it's gaming systems, it's online. It's a big deal. And if you come from the outside, you're going to spend the first, who knows, year trying to figure out where all the bodies are buried.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk. And I was actually just listening to a program about a week ago talking about the CEO search and how the buzz phrase was, well, we need the anti-bomber.
And I don't know if that's true.
And I don't think that's true.
Not at all.
I think, you know, yeah, we're going to malign Bomber. He made a lot of mistakes, but he wasn't a horrible CEO. He didn't drive the company to the ground. And he actually was involved with all the different divisions of Microsoft.
The value of Microsoft from the day he started to his retirement has gone up considerably, right?
Yeah, I don't think Ballmer messed up Microsoft. And I think the odds are pretty good that no matter who was CEO of Microsoft over the last decade, they would not have monopolized cell phones or tablets the way they monopolized the PC, just because almost never does the company that dominates the old world dominate the new one as well.
Right. That's the challenge.
Ballmer did make mistakes, but I think if you think that he was terrible and is to blame for Microsoft not being at the center of the technology world anymore, you were setting a bar for him that almost nobody could have met. Steve Jobs is the one person who did meet that bar.
Well, I think a younger Alan Mulally, Mulally's 68. I think he just wants to retire after a little while. And he's a great CEO at Ford. He turned Ford around. And he's a really great guy, a very impressive guy.
I do find it odd that he has not said,
no,
I will not serve as Microsoft CEO. Please don't ask me to do it.
He wouldn't serve for long. I mean, one of the speculations is that you get a guy like Mulally in for a couple of years while a Tony Bates or somebody like him, Nadal or something, gets a little up to speed as a CEO and then make a transition, interim CEO.
Ballmer said he was leaving, though, because the transition needed somebody who would be with that for the long term. So if they do hire somebody who's not there for the long term and doesn't plan to be there for the long term, that does not jibe with the rationale for why Steve Ballmer is stepping down.
Yeah. I also think that tied up in this question is what is Microsoft in terms of what businesses will stay or go? I mean, there's been lots of discussion of whether online services or Xbox, you know, should be separate businesses. I mean, should it all be this one Goliath? And I imagine those questions, you know, will fall largely on this person. And so, and they're very much alive now. So I think that complicates the CEO choice, but very much still in the background in terms of, you know, what this business looks like and what is the focal point of Microsoft. Is it still Windows? Is it Office? Is it Xbox? These are big questions.
I want to see if that whole, the revamping of the philosophy to go towards devices is going to survive the change in the CEO. Because it actually sounded like a decent change in where we're leading the company. If we're moving away from the siloed version of Microsoft, where Office is competing against server, competing against mobile, competing against entertainment. And now looking at just having users that are in the Microsoft environment, I am actually very attracted to that. If the new CEO is going to say, no, it was better the old way where this division fought that division for resources, I don't want to see that.
Clearly dysfunctional, right?
That's wholly dysfunctional.
Yeah. You know, ELOP, for a while, the thought was ELOP comes in and does do the split. And ELOP said, I think he said he wanted to sell off Bing and Xbox.
That's the story, yeah.
Which is the wrong, kind of, the, I think, if right. you ask me, the wrong thing to do. And not even doable. Bing is so intertwined with what Microsoft's up to that I don't think you can even do that. Satya Nadella, who's their cloud guy, is a good candidate inside. I don't know. I think this is tough. You think there's a Marissa Meyer out there? It's kind of a somebody nobody expected that could be hailed as a conquering hero, as somebody who could come in and turn the thing around. Who would it be?
There's only one person I could think of.
Tony Stark.
Chuck Norris.
Go ahead, Jessica.
No, I was just saying, I'm sure the answer is yes, but it doesn't seem like that's totally the direction that the search is going, largely because of what you identified. This is such a complicated company, right? That you're really, you know, is it fair to throw someone in that who doesn't know some of the nuances? I mean, Yahoo at the end of the day, I think, has straightforward problems, straightforward opportunities. It's quite different, but I don't think we'll have a big surprise on this one.
Really? No. Yeah, because I think Marissa was kind of a surprise, wasn't she?
Definitely.
Yeah.
There's nobody out there who is, you know, famed for being an expert at consumer and famed for being an expert at enterprise stuff.
Right. That's what you need.
And to be the greatest possible Microsoft CEO, you need to be really good at both of those things.
Yeah.
And it will probably be somebody who is really good at one of them and learns how to do the other one.
You did see, though, that interestingly enough, Bill Gates has a back tattoo of Steve that says RIP Steve Jobs 20. No, wait a minute. That's South Park. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
How did we miss that?
Just glanced over at your screen.
This week's South Park. Apparently, Bill Gates gets in a death match with the CEO of Sony, and all is revealed. He's got quite a tat.
I put my money on Bill Gates. He's wiry.
Look at him. Yeah. He's wily too, and he can jump over a chair.
Yes, he can.
I go ahead and do that. I'm sorry. Jessica, just you'll get the idea that we're just not very serious here.
It's nice
It's nice to have a serious journalist.
We have a comic, so we're trying.
You have a comic?
We do. Our first one is out. The comic is free, so
I'm subscribing right now.
Yeah, no, don't say the comic is free. No, that's what I'm paying for. Is a comic.
Okay, there are more comics that aren't free.
You could take your articles. I want a comic. Whose comic is it?
Believe it or not, it's my brother's. But no, my brother is a very accomplished artist and video producer, and so he's doing a series for us. The first one's online, sort of poking fun at folks who are so obsessed with seeing that when their Uber will arrive that they miss the fact there are tons of free cabs in front of them, which is something I confess I've been guilty of. So we're going to continue in that vein, some gentle poking at us techies and how we live our lives. But it's fun. They're fun to do, and I love them, and I've seen so many great ones, particularly online lately, that we thought we had to weigh in.
Oh, where can I see? You said it's online for free. Where can I see the first one?
Oh, it's at the information. If you scroll down, you probably have to scroll down basically to the bottom. It's called Decoded is the slug for it.
I see it. Matt Vascarello.
Oh, your brother's got skills.
Vassalero, yeah.
Vassalero. That's your brother.
That's
studied
brother.
Semiotics at Brown University.
Smart man.
That's awesome. And he lives in L.A. where he writes and directs. And where's the?
So that is the comic.
Oh, there it is. Uber roller. I love that. I love that.
I tried Uber for the first time last night.
Uber's awesome.
It was actually interesting.
I'm not getting in a yellow car anymore. I want all my cars to either have a pink mustache or what is this? Respect yourself, GNC. I love this. This is awesome. Let's take a break and come back with brother of cartoonist Vassarello. How do you say that? Matthew
Vassalero.
Vassalero. Jessica Lesson. And Robert Ballester. Coding 101 betas are when?
Coding 101, we just did one this Friday. We do one in 2 weeks.
Are you going to put that up on Inside Twit?
It's going to go up on Inside Twit.
So youtube.com/InsideTwit.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And then starting in the new year, when we bring in the brand new schedule, along with that schedule comes Coding 101 on Thursdays.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome, awesome. And Harry McCracken from the Technologizer, Time Magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, if you missed anything this week on Twit, here in a short, boiled-down promo is everything you wanted to see.
Previously on Twit, Tech News Today.
Jeff Bezos unveiled Amazon Prime Air.
The first time you get a pizza by drone, you're going to be fired up.
This Week in Enterprise Tech.
The United States Army was caught pirating about $180 million in software.
What? Triangulation.
The floor director at the time, I can't remember who it was, goes, they would like you to river dance. I'm mic'd here, so I can't show you.
Oh, come on. I want to see some river dance.
I went like this.
This is how you get a job.
And I got the job.
Windows Weekly.
Now look at this. This is a YouTube video of a guy swearing at his Kinect.
He gives him a technical foul.
As you get in the game. I think that's awesome.
iPad Today.
This is one of the things I really like about Google as opposed to Siri. With Google, it actually types as you are talking, which is pretty cool. And you know what the answer it found? Symptoms of a stroke.
Twit. Friends don't let friends miss Twit.
You're the Twit, baby.
I didn't know that you guys were dancing behind me. I'm putting my microphone on, and you guys are dancing behind me.
That's what we do.
And nobody goes, hey, they're dancing behind me. No, I just go, people are going, me. All right. Hey, Tom Merritt's here. Let's take a look at what is on the week ahead.
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's a couple things coming up in the week ahead. Not much as things slow down for the holidays, but Tuesday, December 10th, Mozilla's Firefox Metro for Windows 8 is supposed to arrive. Also, the Oppo N1 goes on sale, $599 or 449 euros. And Saturday, December 14th, Ingress, Google's augmented reality game, will be open to all Android
users.
I'm
addicted to that game.
That's a brief look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
You and Chad got me into it. Thank you, Tom.
So
you and Chad
game.
Got me into Ingress. In fact, Chad sent me a beta, but it involved too much walking.
I love that.
I don't want a video game that makes me walk around. I want one that I can go like this and sit and play. So the idea is, and it's not good in Petaluma. That's the other
problem. No, you need someplace with density, like San Francisco.
The idea is they take public buildings and location information, and you go and you're supposed to hack the building.
It's like Capture the Flag, but in real life.
And are you Resistance or?
I am Resistance.
What's the other one?
Enlightened.
I'm Resistance too.
Yeah. Just 2 days ago, I was walking around the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco at 4 a.m.
See, this is why it's a problem.
It's the addiction.
Somebody told me it's best on bicycle because you can get around.
I have seen two people ingressing on bicycles slam into poles. So please walk.
Also, I'm surprised nobody's been arrested as a terrorist because what you do is you go up in front of government buildings with your phone and you start listening. It's talking and it says things like, it says scary things like place a hack it.
I got talked to by the Park Service.
You did.
In Washington, D.C., we had this major event. One of the portals was the White House, but you could only get to it by putting your hand through the gate to get the GPS close enough to the building. So you had dozens of people doing this, and if they didn't turn the volume off on their phone, it was saying, target locked. And so you've got people reaching through the gate of the White House.
Target locked is not what you wanted to say.
It's not smart.
SDC in our chat room says twice he's been accosted by police playing Ingress. So please, now that it's public, be a little careful playing Ingress. It's interesting. Why did Google do this?
You know how much it's a game, but it gets them so much data from people's GPS devices about the maps, about where people are congregating. They can actually figure out movement patterns of people and where they go. And people think it's just a game. For Google, that's actually big data.
Yeah.
It's a great idea.
Speaking of big data, Apple has purchased Topsy. We think $200 million, although some rumors that maybe it's a little bit more or a lot more than $200 million. Topsy was a data analytic company, Topsy Labs, that launched right about the same time as Twitter, and they have every tweet ever published. They have what's called the fire hose of data.
Yeah, they do a better job of letting you search Twitter than Twitter does of letting you search Twitter.
Why would Apple want Topsy Labs?
I think it was not just about social data, because I think that Apple, frankly, doesn't have
it's not their business.
It's not their business, and it's not that it isn't important, but Apple thinks about, you know, software and how we can sell more devices. And so I think I don't just think it's for the raw data. I think it's for the talent and the engineers and the expertise in thinking about software that goes beyond sort of software today. I mean, Apple has this, I think, a strategic challenge in that for many years, iTunes was the killer software that you needed and that got you to buy an iPod and then eventually an iPhone. And Apple's been investing in iCloud is another one of those sort of killer software platforms that you just lock into and that has an intense amount of loyalty, so that keeps you in the Apple ecosystem.
And doesn't work very well.
But it doesn't work very well, exactly. And I think, you know, Apple doesn't have, to Apple, software and services are important in terms of engendering loyalty to hardware. And it needs new expertise in that area. And I think the team at Topsy, it's looking to them to help chart the next course.
I just it's puzzling to me because it isn't in Apple's wheelhouse in any way, or even in their core business in any way.
Well,
and you just have to look at Ping.
But it is. I mean, but it really is. There is a golden cow here in social networking.
I understand it's a good business, but it's not Apple's.
No, but no, not the social networking business itself.
Yeah.
Because most of the tools for social networking have been decent at taking the fire hose of data off of Twitter, off of Facebook, and figuring out trends and influencers. One thing that Topsy was trying to do, and I think Apple, that's the reason why they bought them, is they were trying to get proactive. They were trying to tell you, you want to get your products in this person's hand. You want to get your event in this city, because this is where we're seeing a chain reaction of social engagement. That's absolutely in Apple's business. That's how they sell their products.
So you're saying they're going to take it private, in effect, it in-house and use it for their retail business.
This is their internal engine that says,
that's interesting.
This person needs to be using a MacBook. That person needs to be using an iPad. This person needs our new wearable tech, because they're going to influence everybody else.
That makes sense, actually, because it's clear retail is a big part of Apple's financial success.
I mean, the fact it's not in Apple's wheelhouse is probably a good reason for them to be acquiring companies like this. A lot of it comes back to big data. We know that has never been a strength of Apple's. Examples such as Apple Maps are everywhere.
Right.
And it therefore makes sense for them to acquire people who are good at that. And it may not have that much to do with searching Twitter. The Topsy folks have proven they're really good at analyzing vast quantities of data and making sense of it.
They do sentiment analysis, I think, which is very tricky, where you're not merely saying there were 38 tweets about the Apple Store. You're saying of the 3,800 tweets about the Apple Store, 53% were happy.
That's the same reason it's unlikely that Microsoft will end up selling Bing, because Microsoft also needs to be able to understand vast amounts of data.
Right.
And the closest thing they have to a team focused on that is the search people. And they're going to need that for Windows Phone. They'll need that for Windows 8. They'll need that for enterprise stuff, too. Google is the one company that's already good at that.
Right.
I think there's also to get to the merchandising potential of the data. I think it's less in terms of retail, because Twitter signals or social media signals are probably only one signal, you know, for whether you're going to buy a $2,000 computer. But also, if you think of the iTunes and the App Store and solving discovery problems, like how do I find new apps and how does that keep me engaged in my device? And, you know, Apple bought a search engine called Chomp a while ago for a lot less. But
it was about recommendations, though, app recommendations, right?
It was. But the motivation and people who were on that team have taken on broader sort of data science recommendation roles within EdiQ's organization within iTunes. So I'm not 100% sure if that's the case with Topsy, but I think it reminds me a little bit of that and that expertise. I think that we sometimes forget, I mean, while Apple does sell devices, you know, the App Store has become just this ginormous ecosystem, and people complain about app fatigue and how do you get people to continue to buy new apps, and also music and video and all the other media within iTunes. So I can see Topsy playing a big role there too.
And I guess Apple's got cash to burn. It seems like they could have just, you know, hired Topsy. They didn't have to buy Topsy. They could have just, I mean, that's what Topsy's business was.
But, I mean, that's one of their core concepts. They want to own all the core technologies
have
behind
it all
their products.
In-house.
And so if that's going to be a core thing.
Or maybe keep others from using it. If it's a good technology and Apple's retail could use it, or Apple's recommendation engines could use it, keep it out of the ecosystem so the others can't.
Of course, $200 million is the change in Apple's snack
couch. Oh, it's
nothing.
So, what's the interest on $150 billion in cash? It's got to be more than that a day, right?
A lot.
It's a day's income.
It's nothing. It's nothing.
It's like if I went out and spent $1.50 in a Starbucks. It's nothing.
This is Apple's version of an impulse buy. I gotta have that. Oh, it's shiny.
Let's buy it.
Gift.
You could pay them $1,000 a month, or you could just buy them for $200 million. Right. I'll take it. It's a deal. We'll amortize that in 100 years. I do want to talk more about Apple retail and about iBeacon, because all of a sudden it's like the world discovered iBeacon. Robert Scoble's been on the show many times going crazy about iBeacon. The problem is when Robert Scoble goes crazy about something, I usually go, okay, but really I should have paid attention because this is very interesting. And there's a reason why iBeacon is suddenly going to be a big, big deal. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Squarespace.com. It's web hosting, yes, but it's also the best content management system and the web hosting together. And by making the two things interact like this, you get the best web hosting and the best content management system. A Squarespace sites never go down, for instance. And we got a lot of traffic at our blog site this week, inside.twit.tv. At no point was it unavailable, because Squarespace, when there's more traffic to your blog, they put more bandwidth on it, and it's automatic. It's instantaneous. You'll never even notice the difference. And the content management system, it's so good. It's so elegant. It's so modern. It's always up to date. You never have to worry about security or updates because it's automatically up to date. I want you to try it. Just if you're interested and perhaps you want to, maybe you're looking for better hosting or you want to start a new site, maybe you want to do e-commerce. Squarespace has that too. Visit squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. And all you need to do, you don't need to give them a credit card or anything, is just pick a template. You start with 20 gorgeous templates. All of them mobile responsive. And by the way, that's momentum. I like that one. That's a full bleed. That means the picture goes all the way to the edge of the screen. You might say, yeah, but what about what size screen? Well, it doesn't matter, because even if it's a 27-inch screen or a 4-inch screen, Squarespace sites adjust automatically to fit the screen. So your site always looks great. There's no separate mobile site. It's all there. Even the e-commerce is mobile enabled. That's really special. And that's a pretty looking dog there. So pick your template, but scroll down. You'll see all the different things done with the same template. And that's another thing I like about Squarespace. You don't have to be a designer to have a great-looking site. You don't even have to know CSS or JavaScript or any of that stuff. It's all drag and drop, point and click. You add the social media, add whatever you need. If you are a developer, they have a developer platform. That's very, very nice, but you don't need to be, and that's the point. Every site looks unique. You want a little help, they've got the best customer service in the business. They've got webinars online that you can take. They've got a great active user base and forums, too. So there's always plenty of places to turn for help with your Squarespace site if you should need it. SEO, automatic. It's all taken care of. All the things that Google or Bing or whoever need are done, things like sitemaps done for you automatically. I am just a big fan. Now, if you try it for 2 weeks, and by the way, you can import all your existing content into it. If you try it for 2 weeks and you say, yeah, I kind of like this, check out the pricing. It's as little as $8 a month when you buy an annual plan. Most people go for that unlimited plan of $16 a month. That means you could do something like the information, because you could have unlimited galleries, unlimited blogs, unlimited pages, unlimited contributors, total control over who has admin access, who has publish access, all of that stuff, unlimited bandwidth. You suddenly go, you know, big, you get slashed on it or tweeted or dug or whatever, and you're never going to get a bandwidth bill. Unlimited bandwidth, unlimited storage, and when you register for a year, you get a custom domain and they hook it all up for you free. $16 a month. Want to do e-commerce? They do that too. $24 a month. They do not take a transaction fee. That's it. $24 a month. You get unlimited physical, unlimited digital, unlimited service products. You can have unlimited is the word, right? Pages, storage, unlimited bandwidth, unlimited contributors. They will help you track inventory, do taxes, And that's non-trivial. I mean, all over the country, different taxes, even in different cities. They do that all for you. They will help you with shipping, complete coupon controls. That's $24 a month when you buy an annual plan. And we're going to make it even more affordable because when you use our offer code TWIT12, because we're in December, 12, TWIT12, you will get 10% off your new account at squarespace.com. So the free two-week trial, you don't need our offer code, squarespace.com. But when you decide to buy, use TWIT12 for 10% off. And when you get the annual plan, it starts to add up some real savings. Very impressive site. See, you should have done that with the information. I bet you, you're spending more than $12 a month on your site, Jessica. It's not cheap.
A little more.
we just agreed to redesign our twit.tv site, which we redesigned a year ago, because it's just so dysfunctional. And it's expensive. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, to do it right.
And
it
we're not even doing something as elaborate as you're doing, Jessica. When you look at $24 a month, it just sounds like such a deal. So you might say, well, why didn't you do Squarespace, Leo? We do for our blog, but I think for the podcast, for all the stuff that we do, we're using Drupal, and we need a kind of more powerful. What are you using for your back end on the information, Jessica?
We've built a custom solution, actually. So it's based on Ruby, or it's Ruby.
On Rails, or?
Yes.
Neat.
But we did it that way. In part, there are a lot of great things out there, but we have a lot to our platform, including a lot around newsletters, which is a big part of the offering, and a lot around subscriber management. So we built it from scratch.
You left the journal. You must have used, when you left the journal, said, I'm going to do the information in your mind. Obviously, you didn't say it out loud. Is that right?
I didn't say the name out loud, but I all my editors and teams and friends at the journal knew exactly what I was going to do. Yeah, okay. I was, you know, interested in their views and opinions very much so.
Yeah. And it took, 6 months to do the site, or how long did it take?
Yeah. From the day I left the journal until launch last week was about almost 6 months to the day. We wanted to get out there. When you've got a bunch of reporters who love the news and want to write stuff, you can't really vanish for a year and hold on to your stories. They don't last that long.
No. Yeah, everybody's champing at the bit, I'm sure. And I'm sure the developers are going, be patient. I'm writing as fast as I can. It's very, you know what I like about it? It's very, I haven't paid for it, as you know. But just going to the front page, it's very clean and very straightforward.
Yeah, that's our goal. I mean, we're big believers in the importance of technology and have a lot of ideas around new features and products and ways to improve it. But at the end of the day, it's about our value proposition is the stories and the content. And so we wanted to put most of our effort there. And of course, we don't have advertising and we don't care about, you know, tricking people to stay on the site longer or to click a lot of headlines. So that left up a lot of room in the design.
You know, that's a really good point. I think it is something that has become a bit of a problem reading technology news is link bait. Do they call the lists, the little lists that people
listicles.
Just the listicles. It drives me batty. And of course, you know, all I do day in, day out is comb through Tech Meme. I use Prismatic, which is Brad Cross's kind of social media triggered news site. I use Feedly. I mean, all these tools, Nuzzle, Jonathan Abrams Nuzzle. So I look at, and of course my own, you know, feeds, and I look at tons of stuff, and 90% of it's crap. It's really depressing. So I think I better spend some money.
to chime in. Leo, maybe before the hour is up, we can get you
You got me. I'm sold.
Card, you know, it takes 20 seconds.
But to not have to do link bait just by itself must be freeing.
And I think the other thing that you hit on that I hear a lot and felt a lot is not only is there variety in the quality of the content, but I think there's a lot of the same thing every day. And because everyone's so focused on whether it's Amazon drones or sort of weighing in on these topics that are known to generate a lot of traffic, what you have is a sort of, in any given day, we're sort of consolidating coverage around these attention grabbing topics. Yeah. And I think that there are many reporters out there and there's so much going on in the industry. You know, why is that true? Why are we just all running to the same place on the field? And And I think a lot of the reason is because of the economics of the business models that are dependent on advertising and capturing sort of what there's buzz around. And we think differently. And one of the things that we hope to do is you know, introduce some new points into the daily conversation around tech. So we're not all just talking about the one or two things that happened that day.
Speaking as somebody who will be rehashing your content regularly, thank you. We just hired Mike Elgin, as many of you know. We really want to beef up our news coverage, and even if we could maybe break some stories. I mean, what we do is punditry, but I think you're absolutely right. You can't just be corned beef hash all day. Occasionally, you need a steak.
Right? Hash.
I do like corned beef hash. So let's talk about iBeacon. What I found very interesting this week was the nugget. Okay, so first of all, what is, Harry, maybe you can explain. What is iBeacon?
It's a Apple technology that uses Bluetooth to very precisely determine where somebody with an iOS 7 device is within an enclosed space, such as an Apple Store. And they're using it with a new version of the Apple Store app so that if you're looking at an iPad in the iPad section of the Apple Store, the app knows that and can do things such as give you information to help you decide to buy an iPad.
And it uses Bluetooth LE. But what I found we all learned this week is that it turns out every Bluetooth LE device that Apple's been making, and that goes back to the iPhone 4S, maybe even the 4, is also a beacon. So I've thought for a long time you had to buy a beacon, glue a beacon to the wall, glue
you
a beacon here.
You are a beacon.
So there are stores where they talk about LeBron James' shoe store in Miami, LeBron's shoe store. Every shoe has an iPad display that goes with a shoe. That's not uncommon nowadays to see that kind of thing on a showroom floor. Every one of those iPads turns out to be already an iBeacon that can, with some simple setup, be set to say to your iPhone or your other Bluetooth LE device, oh, you're over here by the Nikes. Maybe you'd like to go over to Adidas or whatever, or here's a coupon. It also could be useful for more than retail, right? I mean, you could use it in a museum, I guess. Are there some non-commercial uses for this?
If your phone is your beacon, you could also use it theoretically turn on lights as you enter your house.
Oh.
So anything that should be triggered by your presence, you could use your beacon for, especially since it's low powered. Now, you want to know why Apple buy Topsy? It's for stuff like this.
Yeah.
These beacons are a major source of big data for Apple. If they can correlate your beacon to something you tweeted, something you put on Facebook, you said, oh, my MacBook's getting so slow. The next time you walk into an Apple store and you walk next to the MacBooks, it goes, oh, you know, why don't you try this? You know, it's been 3 years since you bought your last MacBook. This is so much better. They can custom tailor using the Topsy engine. It's actually kind of brilliant.
Well, and the brilliant stealth move is they've been building this in every Apple device for the last two years, and we didn't know it, and they've flipped the switch, in effect. And I think that's where Apple can really surprise people, is to say, oh, yeah, by the way, it's already everywhere you are. Does this kill NFC, Jessica?
Oh, I was just going to say that. So in sync. Yeah, no, I mean, to me, when this comes out, I think, you know, everyone's been waiting for Apple's move in mobile payments.
And it was clear they never put NFC in any of their devices. It was clear
they didn't. And Google did. And
everybody
was betting on it. And Apple didn't, which actually isn't that unusual for Apple. I mean, people think of the company as very innovative and defining new categories, but it does so by sort of coming in right when there's a more mainstream tipping point. And so not in the very, very early innings. And so they did. They sat and they sort of waited on payments. And I think the sense I was getting from reporting inside the company was that, they really wanted to do something that was much bigger and more leveraged than just sort of point-to-point payments. And I think it's still unclear exactly what they have in mind, but very clear that this is the technology they're betting on to do it. And I still don't think they'll come out with a Square killer or a PayPal killer. It may have that effect of harming those companies, but I don't think they're going to release a product that directly resembles those products, but something broader, something tied in and has a sort of platform components for app developers. But I can't see much of a big future for NFC. It was sort of wavering for a while anyway. But now that Apple's placed its bets, it'll be interesting to see. I barely even used any of those products and am fairly early adopter. So I don't think it's that hard to pull out a credit card. So I'm not sure what the next innovation will come in payments, but I think it's got to be a lot more than just that sort of point of sale thing and more around software and, offers and other kinds of stuff.
PayPal in September announced a beacon. They called it a beacon device for payments with Bluetooth low energy. So this is, but Apple was, now Jessica, you did the best articles about Apple when you were at the Journal.
Thank you.
No, I mean, I read it religiously. Did you have any clue that Apple had this very clever stealth, this seems to me a stealth strike?
I think not directly, no. I did write about payments and the main story I did on this subject in Apple was from the point of view of basically a division inside the company a bit on strategy and figuring out at the most senior levels how aggressive to be and how not aggressive to be. And I think that this was a time frame of probably 18 months ago. And it was clear that they were sitting on the sidelines because of NFC. But I think that Bluetooth, they've been very vocal about their support of Bluetooth LE. I mean, Apple people actually are very involved in the standard setting around it. So that was one big hint that there was something like this. But
we knew if you had a Fitbit which used Bluetooth LE, you knew which devices a Fitbit would work with. And it was an iPhone 4 and S and later, a Mac Mini, a MacBook Air, an iPad.
I mean, Bluetooth LE.
We knew it worked, but who knew that was a beacon?
And it'll be hard for the rest of the industry to catch up just because Apple only has to make Bluetooth LE work in a few devices, and Google has to convince every handset maker that uses Android to support Bluetooth LE in a similar manner, which is going to take a while.
There are Bluetooth LE Android devices.
Yeah, there are some.
Galaxies, but S3 and 4 do it.
Yeah, not yet a standard, though.
It is far from a standard. Everybody's standardized on NFC. Everybody but Apple had put NFC in their phones. Microsoft hedged their bets. Both the Surface has, I think, no, maybe it doesn't have NFC. It has LE. The Nokia has a NFC.
I don't necessarily see them killing each other off. NFC requires some sort of active motion from the user.
You have to tap it.
When I want to bump with somebody, I'm actually holding my phone up against theirs, or I'm tapping a payment screen. iBeacon is more of a location-aware technology. It could be used for payments. It could be.
Used for a lot of stuff.
Yeah, when you walk up to a desk.
I could walk up to you and your iBeacon would say, here's my contact information. Quickset makes a lock that unlocks when I get near it. Right. It only works with an iPhone because it's Bluetooth LE.
Yeah.
But I think they own this.
I'm more worried about that than I am about NFC. I mean,
just
from a wireless perspective, the things that I could do if you've got a pervasive beacon on you, I mean,
I admit, and of course, we're all sensitive to that now, but I just feel like there isn't room for two. That one of these, if I'm a shopkeeper, I'm looking carefully to see what to install. I'm not thinking, I'll buy both. I'm looking at I can afford one, and I'm waiting to see. And I think there was a lot of, I was mad that Apple didn't announce NFC on its 5 and 5S because I thought that's bad because if they don't do it, then that makes every shopkeeper go, well, I'm not gonna take a chance until I see what Apple's doing.
There's also this in terms of a chicken and the egg problem. So the advocates of NFC say that it's not going to require shopkeepers to do it because the actual credit card companies just need to adopt it and they refresh their point of sale terminals, et cetera, et cetera. So it actually doesn't require a huge burden in the point of view of the retailers. You know, I'm not sure that's true. I think but it is interesting. I mean, I think we're at this point where there is going to be, people are going to have to make choices about what to adopt.
Many of them have iPads.
Right.
They got it. What they didn't know is they already have beacons. What I didn't know till this week. I think, talk about cagey move by Apple.
You know, and yes, I mean,
strategically, it's very, very savvy. But I can read an iBeacon from dozens of feet away. I need to be within inches to read an NFC tag.
Right.
So if I'm stepping
back
into my engineer
hat. But
that's
not bad. If you're talking about security,
it's not bad.
Tap to pay is more secure.
That's what I like. I like that. I like the ability to say, there is no way for me to read your NFC tag from across the room. Right. Unless I'm sitting there with a Yagi antenna, and you're probably going to notice
right.
me.
Right.
Whereas with an iBeacon, the whole purpose of an iBeacon is to use low power but give location data a distance away. So now let's say you go into an Apple store. You're surrounded by 50 people all crunching to get the latest iPad. Are you really going to use that as your payment system with all those beacons active at the same time?
So in this case, probably not.
Probably not.
But you're not going to use NFC either because you're Apple.
Probably not.
You're going to have to figure out some solution. I just think it's been a while since we've seen a company do something this clever and surreptitious.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody had any inkling that Apple was putting – we all knew it was a receiver, but nobody knew that they were actually building iBeacons into every single device. There are hundreds of millions of iBeacons out there now. I got one. You got one. Everybody here's got one.
This is Apple's Oprah moment. You get an iBeacon.
Yes.
You all get iBeacons.
Fascinating. And you're right. There's a privacy issue and all of that. Hey, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about Bitcoin. I want to talk about 23andMe. I spit into a tube. Have any of you spit into a tube?
I have.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about it because, well, there's a whole story there. Great, great team here. We're really having some fun. Harry McCracken is the technologizer from Time.com. What are you working on these days? Holiday gift guide, nonstop.
All of our gift guides are done, thank heavens.
Oh, God,
so,
I hate that. I hate this time of year.
We're starting to think about 2014 and talking about the year ahead.
CES going to be huge this year or just a lot of TVs?
Both. I mean, I actually have an email filter, which is taking all of my CES-related email and diverting it into a special folder.
I turn that on every year about this time.
If I didn't do that, I wouldn't be able to see anything else. Yeah.
All the press releases. We would like to meet with you to talk about our new thing. We look forward to seeing what's going on at Time.com and the Technologizer. Mr. Robert Ballesteri, the father, This Week in Enterprise Tech. This is Enterprise Tech, isn't it, iBeacon?
This is Enterprise Tech.
Yeah.
We're getting big data. This is
big data is everywhere. Place. Yeah.
I mean, and the other thing is the location thing. It kind of pales in comparison to the location data you're already giving out just by having a cell phone.
Just, you're beaconing every moment of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Jessica Lesson, theinformation.com. $39 a month, as she said before the show began. Hey, that's what it costs to park for a day in San Francisco. How much could that be? That's why I live in Petaluma, Jessica.
Fair enough.
Free street parking.
Two Uber rides.
A six pack of lattes.
I could go on and off.
I bet you can. It sounds like it's worth $400. And by the way, immediately after the show, I'm paying for it. And also, we thank Chad Johnson, our producer, for his red hair. I learned something interesting at the Christmas party on Friday.
About me?
About you and Father Robert Ballesteri. So, Father Robert, I guess you were doing this, it was like in the middle of the night, even though the cameras were on, because we're always on here at the beautiful broadcast. I finally realized that what I'm doing is reality TV. Okay. I thought it was tech coverage. This is reality TV is what we do here. Did you or did you not stuff a pig down the hole underneath the TriCaster here? Did you or did you not?
I like to take the fifth.
It was not a live pig.
It wasn't a live pig.
It was a little rubber pig.
We were playing around with the TriCaster. Alex was downstairs and Chad and I were upstairs. And Alex had a camera pointed up at the little hole through which all our cables drop. And we were going to show the mascot pig from the TD desk coming down through the little hole.
Oh, yeah, to say hello.
And so we had a camera shot of it going into the hole and it never came out.
So a pig got stuck. Yeah. So maybe people don't understand that. But the way we do this, our technical director's desk, a rotating desk, that's where Chad is right now. Mm-hmm. Are you going to rotate it? He is. It actually rotates.
Just won't hit any people in the studio.
And when it rotates, the camera goes with it, which is bizarre.
Right.
But in order for that to work, you've got to have all the equipment, all the wires from the equipment go down into the basement where all the gear is through a hole. And that hole is fairly large. It's, you know, it's 8 inches in diameter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It should have fallen right through.
Should have, pig should have gone right through it. But the funniest thing is I found out Russell, our IT guy, Russell Tammany, he had to get the, he had to rescue the pig, reached up. And he said when the pig came out, so did a bunch of red hairs.
I don't know where that came from, honestly.
Go Chad.
I don't know either. I don't know what you're talking about.
Chad. He's adjusting the camera so we can see his red hair.
So here's, you know, here's Chad. The desk.
There, that's the view from the desk.
Right. And so
when you're sitting there, do you feel like you're piloting a 747?
Oh, absolutely. It's
like my first 747.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's, I think if we count, there's 12 computers on this desk that we have access to.
Wow.
And then way down there, there's where the desk pivots. It's hard to see because of the studio lights and underneath the desk.
Was that your hair or Gam Gam's hair?
It's my hair. I mean, people's hair falls
the
out.
There, right there. There's that's the great. Hole, right? This is a shot you won't see a lot on network television, but here at Twit, we've got no secrets.
Everyone's hair falls out. It's just mine's a little bit easier to notice it when it comes.
There could have been
when the pig picks it up through the hole at the bottom of the TD
We
desk.
Got some good news this week about our friend Dana Atkinson, who was a founder at Squarespace, went off to create a new company called SumAll, just raised, I think, $4 million in venture capital. SumAll is truly amazing and one of our sponsors, and we love them. Talk about big data and data analysis. The idea of SumAll, and it's free, which is pretty good, because if you were trying to, you know, if you were using one of, you know, SAS or something, that's some big bucks on this stuff. It is free. You connect up all your services, your Twitter, Facebook, Google+, your Instagram, your YouTube, your Foursquare, your Tumblr, Google Blogger, WordPress, Google Analytics, Moz, I can go on and on. You can see everything, eBay. If you're selling on eBay, for instance, you can say, what is the correlation between sales and Twitter feeds or a particular Twitter poster? How does my Instagram feed drive content? Should I, when my mail stuff from MailChimp or Constant Contact, you can see how valuable this is to get a view. This is something that big business has been doing for years, but nobody's been able to afford this as a small business. We use it, and it is so valuable to us in managing our social media campaigns, understanding, you know, how T-shirt sales are impacted by some of the things we do. Lots of people now are using it, and you can too. The insane growth is 20% growth over the last month. Now there are 60,000 companies and customers using SumAll's data analytics service. They've recently added some new ones like Foursquare, and I mentioned Instagram, Tumblr, and Blogger. Stripe, do you use Stripe for credit cards? If you use Squarespace, you're using Stripe for their commerce. Braintree, BigCommerce, and more. You get improved modern analytics. You get integration with related data streams. Personalized daily or weekly emails so that you don't have to even, you get pushed the information. There's an export and spreadsheet view. Many, many features. SumAll now has a mobile app, too, that's gorgeous on the iPhone. Is that your data, Chad?
Yeah, this is.
You track, like, YouTube hits? And
yeah, so this blue line right here is the amount of subscribers that I've gained.
Wow, what happened on that peak there?
This day, and then...
That's an awesome one.
It's actually really cool because you can, you know...
You want to know, why did
jump
this happen?
In.
Yeah.
You can say, this actually was, I was on NSFW that day.
There you go, look at that.
And so I gained 100, and I can even jump in here and say, you know what, on this day, I'd like to make a little note about it. You know,
That's awesome.
Was on NSFW, because in a year, you're going to see that spike and go,
I don't remember
what? Yeah, how did that happen? Right. How can I recreate that?
It is critical these days to be successful.
Exactly. And overlaying multiple versions of information and even splitting it out to compare so I can compare, you know, this is one week of YouTube versus another week, and you can see the...
Oh, that's neat. You can line them up.
Oh, right. Cool. And I can, you know, decide, you know, both of these needs to be, you know, now this is a week versus a week to find out, you know, how I'm performing over time.
And you don't pay for this, right?
No, absolutely free.
I don't. That's what I don't really quite understand. But, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth.
Absolutely. And the amount of platforms, you know, I only have a few platforms that I'm worried about. But
you could do
there
so
are so
much.
Many. Yeah. There's so many. It's amazing. Yeah.
Hey, get your free account right now, sumall.com, and try it out today. It's not like there's a free trial period. It's free. I don't know how they do it. Sumall.com. We're just going to take a break while I watch the 49ers
it's getting very exciting over here.
Because I think if they do, they have a shot at getting into the wild card. And Jessica, you obviously are not an NFL fan, or you wouldn't even be here today. I am barely.
I'm a mild fan. Well,
Is Sam at the game?
No, he's not. But we'll support the 49ers all day long.
Yeah, yeah. It's very exciting, and it looks like it might be almost over. We'll see. Anyway, I'm sorry. Bitcoin.
Yes.
Talk about distractions. What the hell? Father Robert Ballister, what the hell?
Okay, so we know that Bitcoin is this
it's cryptocurrency.
It's a cryptocurrency, yeah. Right? So you have to set your computer to decipher an increasingly difficult cryptographical challenge in order to earn a Bitcoin. Now, way back in the day, 2009, you could do it on your computer, and you get like 1,000 over the summer.
Now you need a custom ASIC that costs $5,000 to even have a shot at.
Right, because every time you decrypt a Bitcoin, it gets more difficult to get the next one. Well, one of the things about Bitcoin was, well, who created it? And there's all these wonderfully crazy hypotheses about where it came from. The NSA created it to destabilize third world economies.
No, really?
Or it was created by mobsters, or it was created by a geek at MIT, or it was created by a group of geeks at Stanford. Well, we've got a story here that talks about how the 49ers have just won the game.
Oh, so that's a good story. Big story.
Sorry, no.
They have. They have 9 seconds left. I don't think there's any way they can lose the game.
That's a different... While they do that, what we're talking about with Bitcoin is that they think they have identified who actually...
Satoshi created it. So this is an interesting part of the story. A guy named, or a group of guys, we don't know, or gals, or whoever, mm-hmm. named Satoshi Nakamoto... released Bitcoin to the wild some years ago, and everyone agrees that the math behind it, the theory behind it, the economic theory behind it, is rock solid. And as whoever did this is very smart. But this person, probably wisely, whoever he or she is, or whoever he or they are, is anonymous and never revealed their identity. Nakamoto did communicate with a few people on forums and so forth, and a guy named Szabo. Nick Szabo has done some syntactic analysis,
which is
not. This is not the first time this has happened.
I'm so geeking out over
Nick,
that.
No, Nick that is the guy awesome. Who they think is Satoshi.
Oh, Nick is Satoshi, the guy who did the syntactic analysis. Another guy. There's the blog post.
She's a she, I believe.
She. Anyway, whoever that is.
So they're looking for specific phrases that people use, a certain type of syntax, because that's like a fingerprint. We all write in certain ways.
Nick was involved with cryptocurrency, and then he sort of suddenly
became less active
when Satoshi came on the scene. And he's denied that he's behind it, by the way.
I've seen, we had the director of the Bitcoin Foundation on Triangulation some months ago, and there was some speculation he might be Nakamoto. Nakamoto kind of handed off the reins to him, and he's kind of run the thing. Although it doesn't need to be run by anybody. I mean, at this point, nobody needs to do anything. This was the guy, I'm trying to remember his name, who was giving away Bitcoins for a while.
Yeah, trying to seed it.
Yeah. But I have to say, I mean, there's been syntactic analysis before. It's not mm-hmm. the first time. There are lots of theories about who Nakamoto is. I guess it doesn't really matter, unless it's the NSA. And then even then, does it matter? I feel like it's just a great story. It's of great interest. There's certainly been, from the financial point of view, a lot of speculation. Bitcoins are going back down now. They peaked at well over $1,000, but now down to $700 or $800 on Mt. Gox. You can see from this graph of 1 month how spiky it is. I mean, it goes all over the place.
One of the things that the story really exposes is there was a little bit of a blip in the value of Bitcoin because there was a story about, why was Bitcoin created? And the creator of Bitcoin actually has now, $1 billion worth of Bitcoin? It's mm-hmm. in the current currency, he's a billionaire.
So that would be a good reason to create it and disappear, buy an island.
Exactly. But now people are drawing back from that story. They're saying, wait a minute. So the people who got into this early are making tons of money off of what we're doing now. If you're getting into Bitcoin now, you have no chance of really mining any sort of fortune, whereas the people who were in it at the beginning have a vested interest in getting more and more people to buy into Bitcoin.
It's almost a pyramid scheme, right?
Yeah.
I also think, Robert, that raises a lot of questions. There's a lot of discussion I hear now about what's the future of Bitcoin mining, and is there going to be money to be made off that anymore, because right now there essentially isn't, because it's so cost prohibitive. But I hear a lot about discussions of new ways and just distributed versions around mining, where the sort of insiders are trying to once again get an advantage. So that will be an interesting thing to watch. But I am personally fascinated by how the Bitcoin believers, if you will, have essentially, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more they talk about it, the more they invest in companies that are related to it. I think that's certainly driven the pattern we've seen. I haven't thought too much about it, but I wonder if it parallels other trends in technology too. You know, have other things like app stores or other sort of innovations been driven by the early adopters who then help make them self-fulfilling prophecies? Because I think that's playing out.
That's kind of the nature of a bubble in general, isn't it?
Yeah.
All bubbles are that way. Early, get in early.
I guess the difference is, like, when is it? Is that just a sort of priming mechanism, and then more fundamentals take over and businesses do get built and there are opportunities, or not? I mean, I think we're still in the early days, right? So it's hard to tell. Although Bitcoin's been around for a very, very long time too, and this is not the first time. I mean, it's the first time that it's gotten to this level, but it's had mini booms and busts for years as well. I think that's something that you don't often read a lot about.
Nope. Some names, by the way, that I'm so bad. I apologize. I'm just an old man. The researcher was Sky Gray, who came up with the name Nick Szabo. And the guy we interviewed is the chief scientist of the Bitcoin Foundation, Gavin Andresen. And that's a worthwhile interview if you're interested in Bitcoin on one of our triangulation episodes a few months ago. You know, the boom-bust cycle that happened with technology in the 90s and parallels something that happened with the railroads in the 19th century. The companies that built the transcontinental railroads almost all went bankrupt, and their investors lost almost everything. But we got the infrastructure from it to power a complete revolution in the United States economy. Same thing in the 90s, in the late 90s and early 2000s. A lot of people lost money on pets.com and dot-com startups like that. But the infrastructure that was laid, the fiber alone that was laid,
all that dark fiber,
has made a huge difference in the economy in years to follow. So there may be a reason for a bust boom cycle. But I guess what you have to do is look back in time, and the difference between a pyramid scheme and a boom bust cycle is only history can tell the difference.
It's law. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the only difference.
Maybe that's it. And there's no law applying to Bitcoin, as far as I can tell. It seems to be a very Wild West thing. Let's talk about 23andMe. The Federal Drug Administration, FDA, has effectively shut down 23andMe. 23andMe was a very interesting startup by Ann Wojcicki. Am I saying her name right? I never say it right.
Wojcicki,
is that right? She was Larry Page's wife.
Sergey Brin's
wife. See, I'm an old man.
Still is, I believe.
maybe still married, but separated. Or something. I don't know what's going on. I can't follow all this stuff. However, that's neither here nor there. It was, I think, a really interesting idea to bring genetic analysis to the cost point where almost anybody could do it. But the last time I did it was $99. And you spit into a tube and you get a big analysis back. But a lot of people have said, oh, the reason the FDA shut it down was they didn't want competition, or I think actually what the FDA did was kind of realistic, because I did pay for 23andMe, and I'm curious, you did it too, right?
I did.
Jessica, have you done 23andMe?
I did. I learned that I metabolize caffeine quickly. And
yeah,
that
it's like useless crap.
The only thing that has stuck with me from it, but I drink Diet Coke late at night. So
I have wet earwax. That's what I learned. And like a 2%... No, that's a genetic marker.
Okay.
What do you have? Have you looked? Go look on your 23andMe.
I cannot process alcohol.
Which
I already knew.
You knew that. The fear the FDA had. First of all, the FDA didn't have any fear. The FDA went to them and said, you need to explain how you do what you do, why you make the conclusions that you make, and it needs to be very clear. So now the 23andMe has a big disclaimer. On the front page, we have suspended our health-related genetic tests to comply with the FDA to discontinue new consumer access during our regulatory review process. I don't think this is inappropriate. I think there should be a – there was no regulatory review because what you get from 23andMe could scare the living daylights out of you.
And you can still buy the kits, I believe. You just can't get the health analysis.
You get an analysis of, like, what your genetic composition is.
You get that, the ancestry stuff.
Yeah. Even that, I didn't find that useful. I'm going to log into my 23andMe.
It's the same reason why we don't like those instant disease tests. You want to do that in the presence of a trained medical personnel so they could explain to you what the test actually means. They could keep you from doing something drastic if you find really, really bad news. So I get what they're trying to do with this. I mean, 23andMe, as they were positioning themselves, could have been seen as, we will tell you whether or not you're going to live a long life. That's not a great thing to do if you can't actually back it up with science.
Right. And I think that's what's going on right now. Now, here's my 23andMe, and I did this before the FDA. So a lot of what – I'm 2.6% Neanderthal.
Sweet.
That's kind of interesting. And it explains why I got hair on my knuckles. My ancestry composition and all of that. But then there's also health risks. And this is, I think, where they get in a little bit of trouble. That's because it can be scary. Mm-hmm. For instance, that you have a doubled – my risk is 1.24 times higher for coronary heart disease. But then you dig down into it, it's because I'm a European, Western European genetic, and that's what you get. And I think some people might get scared. And I think what they want to avoid is an Angelina Jolie moment where a woman says, I'm gonna have a double mastectomy because of what 23andMe said. Now, the point is well made that nobody's going to give you a double mastectomy just because 23andMe said it. You still have to go to a doctor to do it. Nevertheless, I think that it's appropriate for 23andMe to reveal to the FDA and ultimately to its users how this works.
Right.
Right? Did you find it useful, Jessica?
You know, I found it fun. I remember doing it, and I remember I had this cool – my parents did it. So then I saw that I had one chromosome for my mom and one for my dad, and that was very exciting. I don't think I've dipped back into it in a few years, having done it. And to me, this whole episode raises this point that – I mean, we know that science and technology are sort of colliding and that medicine and technology are colliding. And 23andMe is only one of a million companies trying to do something in this space or something related to health. And I just wonder what the relationship between the regulators and the Valley is going to be over these new technologies. I mean, even if you think about wearable devices today, which are fairly benign in tracking our steps, they could do so much more. And as a consumer, and companies and entrepreneurs are working on so much more, and as a consumer, I really want to see these exist. But I also realize that, you know, there are many consumers who need protecting for a good reason. So I think we at work, at the information too, we've been thinking a lot about what the intersection of this landscape is going to look like and trying to understand a bit how companies out here are going to get their products through and what's the best way. And because another interesting thing about this episode, I think, was that 23andMe had been out for so long. I mean, so much, we've used it and it's been on the market. And so there's certainly a lag in the pushback, but, you know, will there be a chilling factor now? So it's going to be a very interesting space to watch. And I think a lot of people were surprised to see this reaction from the FDA, and, you know, we'll just have to see. But I get it. I mean, these things are important, and there's a lot of stuff that normal consumers or people are going to have to be worried about and made aware of. But, you know, frankly, I think this kind of genetic testing is fairly, you know, benign compared to what's technologically possible or will be very shortly. And so what's the fate of that?
Absolutely. I think that in a way, that's what we're talking about here is this is kind of a toy genetic analysis that is, and should probably be labeled for entertainment purposes only. Please.
For cocktail party thoughts.
Yeah, do
my,
not
my
act upon
this. My first genetic analysis. Because this reminds me a little bit of, remember when the Myers-Briggs and the Enneagram were so huge?
Everybody was doing it.
And then people were breaking it out. Oh, well, I do that because I'm a five with wings, or I do that because I'm ENTJ. Well, until you get more science behind this and actually show me why there's a genetic correlation here, it's the same thing. It could be someone saying, oh, well, I do that because 23andMe told me that I need more coffee.
And by the way, it may not be over. I think that they're going to talk. They should have talked with the FDA from the beginning. They're going to talk with them now, show them what happens. And I think I think they will come to a conclusion. And you know what? And then I would say this is a great holiday gift.
Yeah.
Because it's fun, but it's a toy. And that's the that's the point. It's not. It's and having done it, and I think three of us have done it, I think we all agree. Unless you really care about how much Neanderthal you have or whether your earwax
is
wet.
50%. It's weird.
What?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No.
No.
No. In fact, it's a... Well, I don't want to... anybody of European ancestry is 2.6%.
Right.
So it's like, oh, so you're saying it's just normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still interesting, right? I think we... unless there's anything anybody wants to talk about, I think we can wrap this puppy up. I'm just I'm looking here. Anything? We now know that many federal agencies use floppy disks to send data to the Federal Register. This is a publication that published.
Where do they buy
them? Huh?
Where do they buy them?
How do they use them? They got
Amazon
a stockpile somewhere?
It's
brilliant.
Disks.
The problem with using USB drives for SneakerNet is that people can intercept them and get the data. Right. If you get one of their floppy disks, what the heck are you going to do with it?
So this is for the Federal Register, which is a daily publication of the federal government that's required to publish changes in executive orders, proclamations, rule changes, and so forth. All the federal agencies contribute to it. Some of them email. That's possible. It is illegal to use a USB key.
Exactly.
They don't allow that.
Nope.
Many of them CD-ROMs, but according to the New York Times... many of the agencies still send floppy disks in. The spokesman for the Federal Register wouldn't say which agencies, because that's embarrassing. But they were monitoring at the Register's office. Couriers recently seen coming in and out as an employee pulled a floppy disk from one package and at least two CD-ROMs from the other.
I hope they're at least 3.5-inch floppy disks rather than 5.25-inch or 8-inch floppy disks.
No, it's the 5.25, and they had to punch a hole in the corner
to double side it.
Yes.
Well, at least they're being economical.
Someday they'll move to Zip disks.
You're absolutely right, though. Where the hell are they getting these?
I actually needed floppy disks last year, and I went to Fry's thinking they might have them. They didn't. I actually went to the Weird Stuff Warehouse, which
Weird
you
Stuff
might know about,
has everything.
And they didn't sell floppy disks, but I ended up buying a vintage box of Microsoft Word, which used to come on floppy disks. So I recycled a copy of Microsoft
Word. And what's fun is all your floppy disks are labeled Microsoft Word.
Mm-hmm.
Chad has found that, in fact, you can go to Amazon.com and buy iMation 1.44 megabyte floppy.
Now that disks is a Christmas gift. That to the geek in your family.
$35 for a box of 10?
What?
That's highway robbery. Yeah. Doesn't Monoprice sell floppies? That's ridiculous.
What's the price per gigabyte? That
costs. Oh,
ridiculous.
My God.
It is still easy to get a floppy drive. I bought a USB floppy drive for my MacBook Air at Fry's.
Oh,
they didn't
good.
Have any disks for it.
I have USB floppy drive, zip drive. I even have a 5.25 drive. I keep just in case I ever come across a media I want to read.
You never know.
You never know. Good, because I have some floppies with stuff been able to get off.
Let's go.
Next gen USB will be smaller and reversible, kind of like Apple's Lightning connector.
Not compatible.
Oh, what?
And so it's going to break the connections from the old USB standard.
The USB 3.0 promoter group obviously was watching Apple and said, hey, they got away with it. We should try this. That's sad. Although, I do like the idea.
I love the idea, but it means for the near term, computers will have to have both types of USB connectors because no manufacturer is going to say, yeah, throw out everything you have that's USB.
And finally, good news from Congress, and I hope it remains good news. The House passed the Innovation Act, a law to slap patent trolls across the face with a big wet fish. By 325-91, they passed it without amendment, even though there were some attempts to amend it. I presume it goes to the Senate. We know the president will sign it if it does, because he supported it. It's expected to pass onto the White House. If it becomes law, one of the big changes, I think, will be that it'll be possible to recover the costs of a failed lawsuit. Which means it is not free to be a patent troll anymore, or almost free to be a patent troll. It could cost you. I think that'll slow things down. And they've also prohibited fee shifting. Protection for consumers, which goes back to this issue about the there was a company that had a scanner patent or a panerskatten, either way, the panerskatten, and they were going to end users of scanners. They were actually going to businesses and saying, "Hey, you use a scanner and email the result, you owe us money," and that will be also illegal. Thank goodness.
The big one, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow on Twit, Cheebert and I. But the discovery rule is actually huge, because one of the tactics a patent troll will often do is they will keep demanding discovery. And it's the whole, we know you have the proof that will prove that you're guilty,
right,
and we want you to give it to us.
And since the patent trolls are generally shells with no documents, there's nothing they have to do.
Right. But they can just sit back and just keep submitting request after request for discovery. And every time they do that, it's costing you money.
As a participant in an industry that is plagued by a particular patent troll, I celebrate this, and I look forward to this becoming law soon. soon. Harry, it's so great to have you. Harry McCracken, the technologizertime.com. Great to have you. What are you planning for the holidays, going away?
We are going to visit my sister in Austin, Texas.
It'll be warm there, I hope.
Maybe, although it gets frosty there.
The barbecue will be good and the music will be fine, so that's all that really matters. Have fun down there.
Thank you.
It's great to have you, Harry. Thanks for being here. Thank you, Father Robert Ballister. You're back to work tomorrow with This Week in Enterprise Tech.
No, I'm actually going to go down to Austin and visit Harry's sister.
Good thinking.
Let's all
there.
Go. It's nice and warm.
And Jessica, it's so great to have you. Jessica Lesson, we've been trying to get you on since you left the Journal. I guess I understand now why you couldn't. You're kind of busy.
We were a little busy, but it's great to be here. This has been fun.
Good.
Thanks.
And please come back, theinformation.com. My check for $400 is on its way.
Check?
Thank you, sir.
Check. Don't you use checks?
I use NFC.
Oh, yeah. Can I tap to pay?
I've already iBeaconed you.
Thank you for joining us. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC on twit.tv. If you can watch live, do. We love it. We love having you in the chat room. We also have our wonderful live audience every week. And thank you for being here. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv, and we'll put a singularly uncomfortable chair out for you. You agree? Uncomfortable? Yeah. Yeah. We design them that way. Come here, Brian. We got to see Cheebert's hat before we before we sign off here.
My esteemed co-host from This Week in Enterprise Tech, from Hawaii, by the way. So naturally, he is wearing a traditional
this is George Hawaiian
headdress.
Garb. In That's fact, right. I think any minute now he's going to hit a log with a stick. That is the Santa Angry Bird.
You should see the sounds he makes when you throw him across the room.
Thank you to Brian and Kathy for some delicious Kona coffee. That's what powered this show today. If you can't watch live on-demand audio and video, always available after the fact at twit.tv and wherever finer netcasts are aggregated and distributed in violation of every patent law known to man. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Another Twit.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Baby.